the TeachPitch podcast. We are very excited to be launching a series of interviews for TeachPitch, a global community of 50,000 subscribers from over 205 countries to date. And for these interviews, we have selected a number of subscribers who have achieved great things. And by great, I mean amazing. Think of former presidents, entrepreneurs, people who've built hospitals, huge nonprofit organizations, successful journalists, doctors, etc. And what all our guests have in common is that despite their great success, they've encountered many enormous challenges. So what were these challenges and how did they overcome them? That's what we're going to be talking about here. My name is Aldo de Pap and I'm massively looking forward and very grateful you can join us on this journey. So sit back, relax and download the podcast here.
Maybe two or three times in my first couple of years, I was coming across something that I didn't understand or properly grasp because of my lack of legal education. And then within 10 or 15 minutes, he explained that to me and I was good to go. So I was lucky that I had a tutor like that who sort of had that belief in my general capabilities. And, you know, occasionally there's certain issues where I realized that I missed, at least in the early days, that I missed it. And then I simply looked it up and I said, okay, now I understand.
Professor Frans van der Dunk speaks about his journey from being a young graduate in modern history to becoming an eminent authority in space law. We also speak about the times when space and space law wasn't considered to be interesting and how Frans dealt with feeling underappreciated. And lastly, we speak about the changes he experienced switching jobs to a US academic environment after decades of working for a Dutch university. Enjoy this interview with Professor Frans van der Dunk. In this episode, we're going to explore space. More particularly, we're going to look at how human intervention will have an effect on space. And I'm very happy that I'm joined today by an absolute authority on the matter. Professor Frans van der Dunk is a Harvey and Susan Perlman alumni and Otmar Professor of Space Law at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He's also an Associate Research Professor at Lazarsky University in Warsaw in Poland. It is safe to say that Frans van der Dunk knows what he's talking about, having published over 200 articles on the topic. He was also the author of the first comprehensive handbook of space law and is a series editor of Studies in Space Law. There are way too many accolades, recognitions, and acknowledgements to mention when you have a guest like this, Professor, so I'm not going into detail. Professor van der Dunk is being called in as an advisor by several government agencies and institutions such as the European Commission, the European Space Agency, the United Nations, OECD, and a variety of other national space initiatives such as Japan, Brazil, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Germany, Sweden, and the Netherlands. He's an often seen guest in television programs made about space, and if you haven't seen it already, I would highly recommend a TED talk he held in Vienna in 2016 about why we need space lawyers. My guest is particularly proud of his cooperation with the Association of Space Explorers on Near-Earth Object Threat Mitigation, as well as his signature along with many Nobel Prize winners and other luminaries of the original 100 Times Asteroid Day Declaration. I'm sure I missed a lot in this amazing resume, but here goes nothing. Frans, a very warm welcome.
Thank you.
I'm so happy you could make time available for this, Frans, and I appreciate that you wanted to talk to us, because we have loads of questions for you, mainly about all the most recent things that are happening in and around space. Because just last Sunday, we had Richard Branson rocketing himself out of the atmosphere as the first billionaire tourist. And I think in a few weeks' time, we will have Jeff Bezos, who's going to do the same. Both are following Elon Musk, who made a move towards Mars and has great ideas on doing stuff there. What's happening today with all these billionaires making a move into space? What is their game? Do you have an idea?
Yeah, it's an interesting combination of business-like behavior, because obviously they are all businessmen and they want ultimately, or they hope ultimately, that they can make also a viable business case there. But at the same time, they are prepared to spend a lot of money on space, which is still a very uncertain business. I mean, the running joke is that the best way to become a millionaire in the space business is to start out as a billionaire, meaning that it's not very likely, you know, that you're actually going to make revenues. And there comes in another intriguing aspect. These people do not just want to make money, they also want to make history. And in particular, Elon Musk has this vision. He wants to be remembered 1,000 years from now as a crucial person in helping humanity branch out into outer space in terms of settlements and thereby maybe saving the Earth. You can obviously debate whether the best way to address that is to by actually leaving the planet in terms of financial possibilities and how many people can go, but at least that's his idea. And he wants to be remembered as, you know, one of the first pioneers out there. Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos are at the moment slightly less ambitious. Musk is, of course, shooting for the moon and then for Mars. He's been mentioning that for a number of years. At the same time, he's nowhere near there yet. I mean, he's just booked somebody, a Japanese billionaire, to fly around the moon, just fly around the moon, not land there or anything like that. And this is still going to take a few years. As you pointed out, Richard Branson has just launched himself, and Jeff Bezos is going to do so within a week from now, from the moment we're talking. They are, of course, not going that far. I mean, Richard Branson actually, I always want to say, cheated a little bit, because the altitude to which he went was something like 85 kilometers, if I am not mistaken. And even though there is no formal dividing line between outer space and the underlying airspace, most people tend to agree that it doesn't start at 85 kilometers, but a little bit higher, at 100 kilometers. Interestingly enough, if you look at the earlier plans of Richard Branson, he was also aiming for an altitude of slightly above that 100 kilometers. And I'm pretty confident that what actually happened was that when Jeff Bezos a number of weeks ago announced that he was going to fly, and as I said, it's going to happen within a week from now, to over 100 kilometers, Richard Branson wanted to be first. So he basically said, okay, I'm going to, you know, steal your thunder. If my vehicle is not actually ready perhaps to go the full stretch to 110 kilometers, okay, let's go as high as we can, as high as we dare, as high as we are confident we can go right now, because at least we are first. But as I said, it's not really outer space. But that's the third part. They all want to be first, you know,
okay.
That's part of being there.
Yeah, but what I think is very interesting that you point out that it's about making history, not about making money. Necessarily.
Not,
so it's about
kind.
how they will be remembered. It's not necessarily that they see kind of a new massive business arising out of this whereby they're again going to make loads and loads of money.
I would phrase it a little bit differently. They're not seeing it. They're hoping for it, but they take it for granted that it might not happen because nobody knows what's actually going to happen. Of course,
yeah.
They hope that they will recoup their billions in a 10 or 20 year time frame. Both Branson and Bezos are not just banking on the maybe few hundred people that are willing to take these short flights just to, you know, outside the atmosphere to an altitude of 110 kilometers or what it's going to be, and then return to where they came from, which is basically a sophisticated kind of bungee jumping. They are banking on the assumption that the same technology can then be used for flying terrestrial transportation from London to New York in an hour and a half instead of nine hours. And that there is a real market for that. But whether that happens or not is anybody's guess. And they are willing to take the risk. Let's put it that.
Yeah. And they have enough financial resources to take that risk. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for shining a light on this. I've analyzed your profile with big interest. I've had the pleasure of already seeing some documentaries that you participated in and speaking about space, and then specifically more the legal implications of us human beings doing more in space. And it's very interesting if you go to your website from your university in Nebraska-Lincoln, you see kind of a series of articles with very interesting headers, such as, is SpaceX going to impose its own legal regime on Mars, or what happens if someone is killed in space? And I guess these are things that you are sort of an expert on. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. That's part of the, you know, there are many legal questions. I mean, basically everywhere where humans become active, even if it's usually by proxy, as is the case in space, because most activities are conducted from Earth. But whenever humans become active somewhere, legal implications will follow. Conflicts of interest arise, discussions as to what is allowed and what is not allowed, or what is mandatory and what is not mandatory. And that's where the law basically comes in to try and establish some sort of predictability, foreseeability, and justice in human behavior. So as soon as they launched Sputnik in 1957, you got the first serious discussions about the legal implications and how to further arrange for that. And of course, I'm an academic and also a consultant. So I'm at one arm's length removed from that, because the real law is made by the states, basically. But yes, I advise them. I teach my students on the current law and what the future law looks like, et cetera, et cetera.
Nice. Yeah, that's very clear. And so what does happen if someone is killed in space? How does it work? Is it dependent on where this person is killed, or what are questions to ask yourself?
Yeah, well, that's one of the two questions. If I take a step back, if you look at how these things work on Earth, states apply laws usually to everything happening on their territory, regardless of who does it. So if a U.S. citizen commits a crime on the Dutch territory, the Dutch police can apprehend him, bring him to justice, etc., etc. If the law says that you are prohibited on Dutch territory to kill someone, then obviously if you do something like that, even if you're not a Dutch citizen, you can be apprehended and brought to justice. That's the territorial principle. Another very famous principle is that states also apply the laws to their citizens wherever they are. So a U.S. citizen killing someone in the Netherlands is probably also prohibited under U.S. law from doing that, because a murder is a crime everywhere, regardless of where it's committed. So if that person goes back to the United States, maybe escaping Dutch justice, the U.S., on the basis of his nationality, still has the right to follow that person, to prosecute that, bring him to justice, etc., etc. So that's what we call personal jurisdiction. Now, if you translate this to the space situation, on the one hand, personal jurisdiction still remains. You don't lose your nationality just because you're flying in outer space. So if a U.S. astronaut is killing a Russian astronaut on board of the International Space Station, where both the United States and Russia are partnering, then the United States laws and prohibitions on killing someone still apply, and that person can be brought to justice in the United States. The territorial principle, as such, does not apply in outer space, because we've all agreed that space is something like the high seas. No single state can act as if outer space is its national territory, which also means that no state can apply its criminal laws to outer space as if it's its national territory. However, we have in space law a particular system whereby states can register spacecraft, including the space station or parts of the space station. And by doing so, they are entitled to apply what is called quasi-territorial jurisdiction. They are entitled to act as if the space object, similar to a flagship or an aircraft carrying a flag, is a kind of a floating piece of national territory. And thereby, of course, by implication, they can apply their laws on board of that ship, aircraft, or now also spacecraft. And that can include criminal laws as well. So if a European astronaut who is a guest on the U.S. module of the space station kills another European astronaut, that doesn't make them U.S. nationals, but because it's taking place on board of the U.S. module, the U.S. can still say, well, this is kind of equal to U.S. territory, so we can also apply our jurisdiction. What they did in the case of the International Space Station, because of the fact that there are various nationalities working together, is create a special rule whereby they say, first, the state of the perpetrator of the act, the killer, has the right to exercise jurisdiction, meaning that they have the right to try that person as soon as he or she is brought back to Earth. And if that state, for one way or another, for one reason or another, doesn't want to do it, the state of what they then call passive personal jurisdiction, the state of nationality of the victim, still has the right to then take that other state's place. So if the take again the example of a U.S. astronaut killing a Russian astronaut. The U.S. is supposed to be the first to try that U.S. astronaut. If the U.S. authorities, for whatever reason, do not want to do that, the Russians have the right to say, well, it's our citizen which is killed, so we now can prosecute that U.S. citizen. So it's a very special regime.
Wow, yeah. No, I mean, and it's amazing, and I'm happy I can follow all of this, that I say, hey, yeah, I can follow the logic, which is very good and makes a lot of sense. But now taking it one step further, because aren't we going to see lots of colonization in space? For instance, who does Mars belong to? So can at a certain point the United States say Mars is ours if SpaceX is successful in imposing its own legal regime? How do those things work? And can we just go there and say, okay, this is mine now, and therefore, you know, Mars is American, for instance?
Yeah. To start with that last point, no, you can't do that. There is a very fundamental Article 2 in the most important international space law treaty, which is the Outer Space Treaty, going back to 1967, which, by the way, is ratified by all important spacefaring countries. So the United States, Russia, China, the Western European countries, Brazil, India, you name it, everyone who is something in space has signed up to that treaty. So it really provides the generally applicable legal framework. And that Article 2 basically prohibits any national ownership of a part of outer space. So that's why the word colonization, legally speaking, doesn't make sense, because it brings us back to the old days of the 15th and 16th and 17th centuries, when in particular Western European nations had the habit of going to other parts of the world, planting their flag there and saying, this is now a colony of the motherlands. England, France, Netherlands, Belgium, Spain, Portugal, we all built colonial empires. And basically, since the United Nations, colonialism on Earth is no longer legitimate, legal. And this Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty makes sure that it can also not be applied to outer space. So I always point to the fact that, of course, the U.S. astronauts landing on the moon in 1969 and the following years planted U.S. flags there. But that could never mean, and was never supposed to mean, that the moon or part of the moon would be U.S. territory. And by the way, the United States have always been trying to be very clear on that, to clearly say, well, the flag is not supposed to give any claim. We are here on behalf. It's a giant step for all humankind, not just for the United States. Now, going to your Mars example, it also means, because Moon and Mars are, of course, entirely different bodies, but legally speaking, they're in the same basket. So the same regime applies to that. So as long as it's launched from Earth, from the United States, the modules are U.S. quasi-territory, but the underlying surface of Mars and the other parts of Mars are not. So as soon as you step out of the module, you are in international territory again.
And does that also apply to things that are mined? So not necessarily claiming territory, but winning some of the natural resources that are there, if it's proven that these are valuable for our lives on Earth? Is there a similar law that applies, or is it more of a grab there of, you know, whatever you can get is yours?
On the one hand, you have the United States, and I must say a growing amount of, in particular, Western countries who say, well, it's just like the high seas, and you can't own the place. But as soon as it is open for everyone to benefit from, or at least for every state, to benefit from what is there. So as long as you comply with the international limitations to the legitimate use of that area, on the high seas we have prohibitions on overfishing, on whaling, on pollution. As long as you comply with those rights, you can go for the fish, take it out, and make money with it. And as soon as the fish is in your net, it's yours. That's the interpretation that the United States, and as I said, a growing number of other countries, are increasingly inclined to take, which means that you don't need to occupy the area. You just put a mining there, and as soon as you get the stuff out, it's yours, and you can make money with it or whatever you want with it. What you cannot do, even under the U.S. interpretation, is say, okay, this part of the moon is mine. Everybody stays out, and when 10 years from now I'm ready for it, then I'll take the liberty of actually going there. You can't reserve it. If somebody else is quicker there, he or she is entitled to take it. Now, this is still the only one opinion, because opposite, there's a group of other countries and also some experts who argue, no. If outer space belongs to everyone, then the resources in outer space also belong to everyone, or at least to the community of states as a whole. So you can't have just a single state, meaning so far basically the United States, although Luxembourg and United Arab Emirates are quite ambitious in the same area as well. But you can't have a single state or a few states determining on their own, out of their sovereignty, hey, I'm going there, or I'm allowing my companies to go there and take whatever they want. No. We need an international regime, maybe an international licensing agency before we can do that. And the discussion between those two points of opinion is still going on.
Wow, there's so much to it and so interesting. And with everything you say, I feel new questions coming up. So I think we can talk for hours about this. Absolutely. One question I do have, though, is you keep on saying, yeah, you would be violating a law. What happens if you violate a law? What are our means of reinforcement here? Right? So if someone says, well, I'm taking all this off Mars and other states do not agree, how do we make sure this doesn't happen?
That's unfortunately a question where we don't have a real legal answer. Differently from national legal orders, where we have a well-weathered and generally accepted court system, where the police has powers to actually apprehend suspects and put them in jail or enforce fines. We don't have anything like that in the international arena. So if it's a powerful state, the only thing we have is things like political measures, boycotts, trade boycotts, or saying, well, if you ignore what everyone agrees is the law, then, you know, we will do the same. So the fear of escalation may be holding back to some extent. But of course, as a powerful country, you're able to get away with much more in that regard than if you're a smaller country. Now, the interesting thing in terms of mining is that even the United States and U.S. companies, the United States by now, certainly since the Soviet Union fell apart, is the leading spacefaring country. China only starts to become a bit of a competitor in that sense. But even the United States can't afford to say, well, you know, we ignore that everybody else would disagree with the fact that we think that our companies are perfectly entitled to mine these resources. Because think for a moment. These companies want to mine those resources in order to make money. They want to be able to sell it to everyone who's interested. And if the rest of the world is, for whatever reason, a hypothetical scenario, because it's more like divided so far, but if the rest of the world is basically saying, we don't accept this as legal trade stuff, we think this is similar to blood diamonds, you know, to quote our example, we are never going to buy it. And even worse, if we are able, we're going to lay our hands on that. Then it means that the companies can only sell it in the U.S. market because the U.S. recognizes their right to do so. So instead of a market of 7 billion people, they only have a market of basically 300 million people. So there is an economic interest on the side of the United States to try to come to some sort of understanding, allowing their companies to sell the stuff worldwide. And that's kind of what's going on behind the scenes right now.
Yeah, that's a very interesting take. So they would be spoiling, you know, their own market opportunity or ruining their own market opportunity if they were to say too quickly, this is all mine, because, exactly. You know, they would miss out on many more consumers, many more future consumers.
Yeah.
Very interesting, Frans. What got you into all of this? Because this is quite a specific niche area. And how does a journey into wanting to become a space lawyer start?
Well, in my case, it basically started by accident, because you should realize that I'm a Dutch citizen. The Netherlands, frankly speaking, is only a third league spacefaring country. It was not self-evident that we would play a major role. On the other hand, Netherlands has always prided itself on being very legally oriented, international law. The Hague is often called the legal capital of the world, and the International Court of Justice is located there. But basically what got me into that was a little bit of an accidental trajectory. I studied history, including modern history. At some late part of my studies, I added public international law to my curriculum, and I got more interested in law than I thought I would be. International law is an area of law where you have a lot of politics and even philosophical questions and international relations engaged. And then in the international law section of the University of Leiden, where I was hired more than 30 years ago, there was a very small institute of air and space law, and by sheer stroke of luck, the position of the space law co-director became available. And I thought, well, that sounds nice, you know, that's a very much a niche area, very international, of course, but it wasn't the elaborate conglomerate of legal regimes, national and international, that it is now. It was much easier to comprehend, so I could pretty easily step into it and grow with the discipline. And it was fascinating. I mean, every young kid has some kind of a fascination for outer space. What is behind the stars? Is there an end to this world? Where do we all come from? These kind of questions. So it intrigued me, and then I got into it and never left.
Wow. So just so I get this right, you started with an academic interest from modern history to international law. You were not necessarily someone who wanted to become an astronaut. So it wasn't the space first. It was more the academic route and finding your way into that. Are you from an academic family?
Yeah.
Okay.
And actually, a funny thing maybe is that actually before I started studying history, I studied for 1 year Egyptology, which is the science of old Egypt. And in a sense, I recently realized going through in another conversation that in one sense that has come full circle, because the Egyptians, the old Egyptian religion, places enormous value on space, on the heavens, because, you know, the solar system determined how the Nile, as their life blood, was able to grow their corn. So they were in a very early age, you see them very much focused on the location of stars and the daily rotation of the sun and night, and the sky goddess was a very important figure in Egyptian mythology. And now we are back in an age where everybody starts realizing that as humans, we can't survive without making use of space. We don't necessarily need to go there, perhaps. Certainly not all 7 billion of us, as we started speaking about earlier. But at least we need the satellites for, you know, for communications, for remote sensing, for navigation, and all sorts of purposes like that.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to hear that things came to a full circle for you with Egyptology, and then now being where you're at in such a beautiful academic arena. As a first challenge, and you've already described the majority of it, but you said like not having a full legal education was a bit challenging. Getting yourself into space law. Do you feel you would have been better equipped if you were more of a standard lawyer and then as a specialization of a law degree get into space law? Would things have looked different for you then?
They might have looked slightly differently. I would prefer to say that everything has its advantages and disadvantages, which is, of course, you know, the statement, every advantage has its own disadvantage, to quote our most famous philosopher, Johan Cruyff. But it is true. I mean, I posed myself that question when I was, you know, starting to be engaged in at the Leiden Law School, first within the international law section. But I was very lucky that the chair of that section back then was Professor Kooijmans, a very inspiring figure. And I asked him, well, do you see me teaching international law if I've never, you know, graduated in criminal law or civil law or family law or anything like that? And he said, well, I've seen you operating. I'm not too worried. If you come across something that you are not familiar with, you know, just come to me. He also gave me like an introduction into general law and said, well, first read this. And if you have problems, just come to me. And like maybe two or three times in my first couple of years, I was coming across something that I didn't understand or properly grasp because of my lack of legal education. And then within 10 or 15 minutes, he explained that to me, and I was good to go. So I was lucky that I had a tutor like that who sort of had that belief in my general capabilities. And, you know, occasionally there's certain issues where I realized that I missed, at least in the early days, that I missed it. And then I simply looked it up, and I said, okay, now I understand. So the drawback of not having a full legal education was basically minimized thanks to Professor Kooijmans. The advantages are also there because space law, probably even more than normal legal disciplines, is contingent upon, you know, understanding of international relations. We already talked about the impossibility to properly punish offenders of space law. You need to understand international relations, politics, history, philosophical questions in order to be good in space law. You also need to understand something of the technology and the science behind it. So in that sense, I think it is actually a bonus that I had a lot of non-legal education also to bring to the fore.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting to hear your first steps into this. And then as a second challenge, you describe that it was difficult the very beginning of things because you just said it was a very small department. I can imagine you needed to do a lot to make sure that your department would gain traction, that people would be well informed and, you know, maybe needed to fight a little bit for your right to exist as a department. So as a second challenge, you described that it was difficult to mentally survive when you felt rather underappreciated in your direct working environment, specifically when you compare the broader world of space law and policy. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, well, part of the problem was, of course, going back to what I said earlier, that space, it's getting slightly better, but certainly back then it was, you know, a third-ranking space nation. We had world-class astronomers, including some Nobel Prize winners, scientists who learned about the universe and where it came from and things like that. We had world-class engineers coming from the University of Delft who were picked up by the Boeings and the Airbuses of this world to build all the space technology. But as soon as we would actually go into outer space, which is where space law starts, the Netherlands really wasn't a big country, which also meant in the larger picture of the law school that, you know, space law wasn't seen as a serious discipline. And even within the institute, air law has always been seen as much more important. So there were a lot of hurdles there, which at some point really started frustrating me. And if I looked elsewhere, that was even more frustrating on the one hand. On the other hand, it kept me alive. I saw that possibilities elsewhere were being grabbed, were being seen, and that, you know, I was given the opportunity to play a part in that. And that, of course, ultimately then resulted in my being hired away by the University of Nebraska 14 years ago.
Yeah, well, I have one observation. It also sounds like you started your academic professional career in a time whereby the university policy and the government policy were closely related. I think now we live a little bit more in an era whereby the university is a force in and of itself, so that it doesn't really matter, you know, the country where the university is located, if the expertise is very high and if there's a good department there that knows what they're doing, then the merits will come automatically.
Okay. Right. Certainly in an area like space law, which is as international as you can get, right?
Correct.
From the get-go, there was this international globe-spanning network, which has only intensified over the last decades. Yeah. But yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. And for that matter, how many space law departments are there now, you know, in universities globally? Would you have an idea?
If you talk about departments, it's still, you know, limited to probably a handful or a dozen or so. You know, I'm not sure how many there are in China, where they are, of course, very big on space since a decade. So if you look at academic colleagues, I'm pretty sure that the number of people who can call themselves space law professor runs into the hundreds worldwide, if not thousands. Then I include the associate and the assistant professors, and many of them are just starting to do that in universities somewhere in India or China or in other parts of the world. So it is a kind of a pyramid, but it's rapidly growing, absolutely.
And I can imagine that the number of space lawyers, they're not all active in academia because they're also hired by big companies, I can imagine.
Yeah. Well, it depends a little bit on how you define space lawyer. Huh? If in an Anglo-Saxon context, I say I'm a space lawyer, often people think that I actually go to court and sue someone else. So, you know, that's what a lawyer is in the narrower sense of the word. But if you take a space lawyer as anyone who professionally is engaged in questions of space law, whether it is as an academic or a government consultant or a company consultant or working with an international organization or with a research institution. And when you take space law as not just the handful of UN treaties, but any legal regime that is relevant for space, so it includes, for example, how copyright law works when it comes to pictures not taken by your photographer on the street, but by a remote sensing camera, or how liability works when you're driving your car and you're guided by some satellite to go left or right. If you include all the legal stuff which is relevant for space activities, and you then address the number of people who are professionally engaged with it, then I'm pretty certain that we're running maybe already in the tens of thousands, globally speaking.
So not only the things happening in space, but also the things happening from space on Earth would basically fall under the advisory capacity of a space lawyer.
Least in theory. I mean, the result is, of course, that you see many people specializing. You have many people who are very specialized in satellite communications law, and others are focusing on satellite remote sensing law. You see that specialization coming up, which is logical if the field expands, if the discipline grows and becomes more and more intensive. At some point, you can't follow it all in great detail anymore.
Hmm. Fascinating. So before we go to your third challenge, which is all around you moving from the University of Leiden, where space and the understanding of space and space law was relatively limited, you made a move towards the United States. I wanted to shortly address the work you do with Black Holes, which is an advisory company that you founded. What exactly does Black Holes do? Could you explain that to us?
Yeah, well, it's in simple words, it's providing anyone who is interested to pay for that to a certain amount, advice on issues related to space law, again, in the broad sense that I just described. That can be a private company who is interested in doing piggyback launches, as secondary payload launches, whereby they use the empty part of a payload bay because often the big satellite still leaves a little room on the top, and if the big satellite is anyway paying for the launch, somebody might be interested in doing a secondary small payload, like an experiment, on top of it. And suddenly, instead of paying tens or hundreds of millions of dollars for the launch, you maybe need to pay just $50,000, because the thing is flying anyway and it's a small experiment. There are questions. That company stepped into that business, and there were questions immediately about, but are we then also potentially liable if something goes wrong? So they asked me, okay, write us a report. How does liability work in that context? So that we can, appropriately take that into consideration when we sign our contracts, to make sure that we're not on the hook for multi-million dollar damage if we just pay for $100,000 for the privilege of being a secondary payload. That's just one example.
But that's very exciting. So you're the pioneer in drafting the very first words on the space law of an entire nation, right? I can imagine that must be very exciting.
Yeah. It was a subject by one of these documentaries of the VPRO called The Race to Space, The Race naar de Ruimte, where they actually focused on that particular part, where they, where they really filmed me sitting in a hotel room typing Article 1 in its very, very first initial draft.
Yeah, and I would highly recommend it. Previously, we've also been working on creating some educational material that our listeners could use for either their own understanding or maybe passing it on to their students. So teachers and students have good ideas about what space law is and what it all implies. And I would highly recommend the content because it's very comprehensive. It's short. It's very nicely done. So yes, definitely check out the website, blackholes.eu, if you have a moment. And then we go to your third challenge, Frans. We left you with challenge two in Leiden, in the Netherlands University. You felt a little bit limited in your capacity to act and kind of, moving on a smaller scale. And then all of a sudden you get offered a professorship at a U.S. University. What was that like for you?
Well, it was an eye-opener. I mean, I realized that coming from a third-league spacefaring country, to use again that term, to the single superpower in space, and to a program which was actually established as the first postgraduate space law program in the United States, with the support of the highest military authorities who run the U.S. military space program. That was really such a difference from the Netherlands that I really had to, you know, scramble to understand what all the differences were. And the challenge was, in a sense, of course, that U.S. universities are structured in many ways rather differently from the way in the Netherlands or in Europe we address that thing. So just to give you an example, in Europe, it is usually the taxpayer which still pays the larger part of universal education. Of course, in the U.S., every student basically pays for their own, or it's their parents if they're rich, or if they're lucky, they get a scholarship. But they paid huge sums in order to get the education. So the mentality of the students was, since I'm paying, you know, $30,000 a year to get this education, and I'll probably end up with $100,000 debt before I get my first job, I want to get everything out of that which I can. Whereas in the Netherlands, we often have a lot of discussion about, you know, the minimal culture whereby many students consider it okay if they're just passed because they also want to do other stuff, right? I mean, it is a black and white story, but it gives you an idea of the differences. On the other hand, it also means that in the Netherlands, students are much less competitive in the sense that they are willing to collaborate more. In the U.S., it's all about rankings, rankings of individual students in classes, rankings of university on a nationwide scale, which determines how much students are willing to pay to get an education with that university. So there are a lot of things totally different. And I was so grateful for that opportunity and everything that they wanted to offer me, and the way they, you know, they made clear how much value they placed on me getting over. I felt so welcome that it is very easy then to open yourself also up to advice, basically understanding, sure, I'm very happy, but please be aware that there may be things where I need some learning in order to understand what's going on. But they were all very willing and gracious and explained it to me. So it, looking back, it wasn't that much of a challenge. And actually, I learned a lot about things that are good about U.S. legal education as compared to Dutch legal education, but also things where, you know, which we take for granted on Dutch universities or European universities, more broadly speaking, where I learned in the United States that it's not all that, you shouldn't all take all that for granted.
That's great to hear. And I'm so happy this all worked out for you and that you are also able to really grasp the difference between the two worlds, right? Because, I would agree with you that it's a lot more competitive in the United States. And that brings me to the question, which other universities in the United States are around that have focused so much on space law? Or is your university kind of the most renowned one that is making such an effort?
No, I can't really say that. I mean, we were the first one to have a program at the postgraduate level. Now we have a couple of universities which have followed us. University of Oxford, Mississippi has one, although it's almost completely online, even before COVID. They're doing something at Marshall College in Cleveland, where they have a center of space law. There's a Space Policy Institute in Washington as part of the George Washington University. And policy and law are not the same, but are at the same time quite interlinked. So they do some legal stuff, some legal classes there as well. The interesting thing is that, you know, when you look at U.S. universities, there were a handful, of course, even before, you know, Nebraska stepped into the breach, which had space law programs. And they were all in much more logical places in the sense that they were either in Washington, which is the capital, which where space policy is made. So the Space Policy Institute, Georgetown Law School, a famous law school in Washington, D.C., also has a renowned space law program since many years. You have some stuff in Florida where they launch much of it. You have some stuff in Houston. You have in California, University of California, Los Angeles. And again, California is one of the big space industry states within the United States. So that all made a lot of sense. But Nebraska in the middle, it came quite as a surprise to many people, even in the U.S., that we went actually to Nebraska. It has a lot to do with the fact that in the other big city of Nebraska, Omaha, you have the U.S. Air Force headquarters, which until very recently were responsible for the U.S. military presence in space as well.
Where elsewhere would you say?
Well, the traditional institutes, apart from Canada, McGill, which is the oldest in terms of space law, you have an even older institute in Cologne, which started as an air law for many years, but added space law. You have the Leiden Institute, you have something in London, in Rovaniemi, and you have new spacefaring countries. China is big. India is of course, huge. There may be dozens of law schools by now who have some space law teaching going on. The interesting point that I always want to point out is that all of them, as far as I know at least, combine space law with air law. Just like with the issue where I came from and back in Leiden.
There you go. Thank you so much for describing your challenges and for talking us through this very interesting field of space law. We're almost at the end of the interview. I always close this interview with two questions. The first question is, what book would you recommend to people listening in? If there's one book you could recommend to our audience, which book would that be? And it cannot be your own book.
It cannot be my own book. I was going to ask, yeah. But it must be about space law, right?
No. It could be about anything. Anything that grabbed your attention and that inspired you. Doesn't have to be professionally related.
Oh, okay. Well, the book that that inspired me back as a teenager, but that has little to do with space, is The Lord of the Rings. If you want to do something with space, I liked pretty much the work Moon Dust, which speaks about how the lunar astronauts experience their life-changing trip to the moon, and in particular, not just for the space law parts, but also the larger philosophical questions. So what does it do to a human to step out literally into another world where no one has been before? And what does it mean for your life if you are 35 years of age and maybe have another 35 or 45 or 55 years ahead of you? Can anything down on earth ever beat that experience? And the book Moon Dust by Andy Smith gives a very intriguing answer, because he actually interviewed many of the people who actually set foot on the moon. So that's a very interesting book for those.
Nice. I think that's a very good tip. Moondust and Lord of the Rings. And then our last question. Now let's turn the tables. Who would you want to invite for a podcast interview? So if you were the host of a podcast, who would be your guest?
That goes to one of my other interests. I would love to hear David Gilmour, the old guitar player of Pink Floyd.
Okay. And why is that?
Well, a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that, of course, Pink Floyd is my favorite band. I've been interested in the history of the band for ages. It's not accidentally that my company is called Black Skies. If you look at my business card, and the explanation is also on the website, that has to do with a line from one of the Pink Floyd songs. Pink Floyd has often been seen by accident as, the space band par excellence. Everybody's heard of the Dark Side of the Moon. And that also goes back to the theme that I just described. The interesting thing is that, these astronauts came back when they were 35 years of age from the moon and had to have a life after that and had to something to strive for. Well, the Dark Side of the Moon was an enormous success for Pink Floyd. And they faced the same question. They were actually in the late 20s when they scored that multi-million seller. They didn't need to lift a finger for money. So what inspired them to still carry on and make some, in my opinion, great albums after that as well? And I have some personal thoughts on why and how that went, going back to the specifics of the history of Pink Floyd, which is a very interesting history, of course. And I would love to have an opportunity to talk to him, and see whether some of my hunches, whether he agrees to that. It could also be Roger Waters, who is the other big guy, of course, in the team. But I have a sense that Gilmour is a little more open to, outsiders who may not understand what it really is to live through a life like that. But anyway,
David Gilmour and Roger.
That would be perfect.
Okay, so David Gilmour and Roger Waters of Pink Floyd. We'll see what we can do.
Thank you.
Professor Van der Donk, Frans, thank you very much for doing this interview. I've learned a lot, and I hope our listeners did as well. If you want to know more about the work of Professor Van der Donk, please go to his website, which is black-holes.eu. There you will find out a lot more about his work. Also be sure to go to the TED website and check out his TEDx talk that he held in Vienna, which I think is a very good intro to the work that he's been doing and why we should have space law and space lawyers around. Thank you very much for making time available, Frans. It's been a great pleasure and honor having you. Thank you so much for joining.
You're more than welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
If you liked this episode of the Teach Pitch podcast, then it would mean the absolute world if you could share it with your friends and or give it a short review on your preferred podcast platform. The more you share your ideas about these interviews, the more people will find out about them. So do let us know what you think. We'd be very, very grateful.
Special thanks to Kevin MacLeod for our beautiful theme music, La Grande Chase. This podcast was produced and edited by Natalie Piles. Project coordination by Inva Cheney.